understand why the two-leg ladder and the three-leg ladder would behave differently, and that would go on for, so the even leg ones would be gap full and short-range spin correlations, and the odd leg ones would behave asymptotically as the single chain with these power law correlations. So let's take a look at that. So first let's look at some finite temperature properties. So let's look at the magnetic susceptibility. We already looked at it for the single chain. So this was the prediction from these low energy field theories. And now we expect the same kind of behavior for any odd ladder width. So, but then these constants here will change. So T naught will change. And the C here as well, which is a velocity. What else? Well, for the even leg ones, we expect, because there should be a gap, then the susceptibility should decay to zero when the temperature goes below that gap, so we should have this asymptotic form. Turns out there's a square root there too, which can be derived also from this strong coupling picture that we discussed, where you have a much stronger coupling between the chains. One can derive that kind of form, and it should be generically valid. So let's look at just some results. So here I did some SSE calculations for very large chains, and these chains are large enough for the temperature shown in these graphs so that you can treat it as infinite size. I mean, it's converged. So it if you would have the infinite size result, it would go right on top. Okay, there are several curves here, so it looks a little bit messy, but maybe it helps that the odd leg ones are in black and the even width one are in red. So you can see all the red ones eventually have this exponential decay visible here. So this is not now a finite size gap, but this is due to the actual gap persisting in the thermodynamic limit in these chains. Whereas for odd width, this is what we looked at before, the single chain result, and then you get three chains, five chains, and so on. Well, one thing to note here is that if you look at the, let's say, magnitude of these results for odd lengths, so 1, 3, 5, it looks like they also go to zero, and actually you expect that. So, in fact, this form is valid, but this C may actually not be the velocity here. I think there's another factor here, which is not really C, but I didn't put it in there. But you can understand it from this picture. So when we look at the susceptibility, we look at the susceptibility per site. And here, if you believe this hand-waving picture here, you can think of it more or less as at low temperatures, you don't get any susceptibility from the part of the chain which is participating in this short valence bond formation. So you only get the susceptibility from this part, which essentially is the leftover spin one-half chain, effectively speaking. But then you see that if only that contributes, then the susceptibility per site will be down by a factor of one over the number of chains, right, relative to just the single chain. So that's why this is actually suppressed here. And one can analyze that, and it turns out to fit very well, but I don't want to do too many details here. Okay.
So does that mean that in the large LY limit, that the difference between the even and odd chain goes away?
Right. Okay. Right. And in fact, you can see that here. Here is the same stuff, but blown up. So you see here 2, 4, and 6 chains, 1, 3, and 5. And here you see that the 5 and 6, they actually are right on top of each other. So if I would do wider chains, they would not have a different behavior here. They would start to differ at very low T. But down to some T where down to where the gap becomes visible in the even with chains, at some point it will converge. And that will actually then more or less correspond to, well, really, not just more or less, but really correspond to the two-dimensional limit, right? So this is already in the two-dimensional limit here. Good point. All right. So one can actually extract the gap then for the even width chains from this form. Well, one can, let's say, test the form. So this, again, was a form derived in the paper on the previous slide based on a strong coupling, or let's say weak coupling between the rungs. So one can test the form, and then if the form works, we can extract this delta. So if you now just take multiply with square root of t on both sides, and then take the log. Let's see, did I do that correctly? Log. Maybe this t should be inside here. Well, I can't see it clearly, but in any case, what you should see is that you should, if you do it correctly, maybe here is correct, t log. Well, it's probably correct. Let's see, t log. Right. So it's correct. Yeah, okay. I didn't see. I actually multiply. So first you multiply there, and then, yeah, exactly. So if you do it, you should get on a log scale, which is not what I have here. Yeah, well, this is actually what I have here. I think it's not. No, it's not logs. Now I'm confused what I have plotted here. So this should be a straight line. I'm pretty sure that this should be a log scale, but there's something wrong there, or maybe I just fitted that form. I'm confused now. But in any case, you can take this form and... No. I'm really confused, because this is just a log of a constant. Yeah, sorry, I'm completely confused by my own graphs today. So this is not a log scale. This is just log of a constant. The point is it should be this linear in T form with the offset being exactly the gap. And you can see these blue lines are fits to that. So from that intercept here, you can get those gaps. And there are various predictions for how that gap should scale with the width and so on. And it works pretty well, but let's not go into that detail. Anyway, so this is... This was the finite T properties. Now let's look at these spin correlations, where we expect that form for odd width and this for even width. So here there should just be a purely exponential decay. So gaps and exponential decays always go together in these spin systems. So. And this correlation length is normally something like 1 over the gap. Okay, let's look at some results. So here again are four for the correlation at the longest distance of a given Lx as a function of that length Lx. So this is up to chain lengths 2048 in this case. And again, I plotted at some logarithmically spaced points. All right, what do we see here? Let's look at the odd width one. This was, and now it's well, this is the red ones. And now it's plotted again on, so this is a log scale, right, because this is logarithmic as well. So this is what we looked at before. So this is basically this 1 over r, but we showed that it was modified by this log. And you see that you get the same sort of behavior for all of them. But now again, the correlations are suppressed. And that again has to do with the fact that we effectively get this contribution just from one chain out of all those chains in the ladder, because you can think of the rest as being some inert background that, an inert background that gives you some exponentially small contribution, because the even width ladders, of course, have some spin correlations as well. and they decay exponentially. So you see on this log-log plot, you don't get straight lines, you get faster decays. And you can see that this is again related to the gap. So if the gap is large, like for Ly equals 2, you decay very fast there and then increasingly slower. And again, you can see here that we have some sort of convergence to a 2D limit almost already here. Well, you cannot really see. So in the 2D limit, as we will soon discuss, the correlation should just go to a constant eventually because there is a long-range order. So here one cannot really see that, but 5 and 6 are pretty much on top of each other here. But so again, what you, in some loose sense, what you can think of is that the odd length ladders consist of some ladder of even width plus one chain. And when you, of course, this is just some effective picture, so you know there are fluctuations and so on, and sometimes that chain is on the other side. But loosely speaking, it you can think of it as something like that. So so that's why again why these go down, because when we calculate the correlations, we use all the spins, but it's just that one effective chain that contributes, so it goes down by pretty much one over the width. Okay, so yeah.
But do we have the same result where we think the size goes to zero for the order of infinity?
What would you mean the size going to zero?
Sorry, going to infinity. Like we find a size.
Right. So for if we let the chain length go to infinity and the width go to infinity, eventually we should get the result of 2D systems. And this is what I'm saying here, that here you already see that the odd and even width ones behave very much the same on these short distances. And if, as you increase the width, which is a little bit difficult to do because, well, it takes longer and longer, so I'm not aware of anybody that has studied really more chains than that systematically. But what you would see if you could do it is probably that it should converge to something which it should go to, let's see now. So it's also this 1 over L factor there. So I guess actually what I should have said was wrong. This should probably not go to a it should, because, you know. I mean, eventually it should go to what it does in the 2D case, which is this goes to 0.1. So actually it should go somewhere up here. So I'm a little bit confused now why it doesn't exactly go there. There may be some normalization issue. But regardless, at least when the bits become large, even and odd should not show any difference. But why it... this may already be in some length regime where it's really not behaving two-dimensionally, because this length is already... So I mean, to see two-dimensional behavior, I think one could only see that up to distances which are less than the width of the chain. So now our largest width is 6, so maybe up to 6 one could see some kind of 2D behavior, but on this scale, where you see this is LX is 2 to the M plus 1, so it would be, you know, maybe here you can see some 2D physics. So maybe this regime is not really relevant. Let's move on. Let me discuss the correlation length. So we discussed the correlation length when we talked about this classical critical systems, and of course if you have a disordered state and you look at the spin correlation state, they eventually decay exponentially like this. Depending on the dimensionality, there can be some power law prefactor here too, which I didn't put down here, but the exponential form is the most important. And normally this correlation length is related to the gap. So the correlation length is the inverse of the gap. Okay, so now let's say we want to compute the correlation length. What do we actually do? We could extract the spin correlation functions at very long distances, as we have done. I mean, we could take, for example, these results. In the case of the even with ladders, we should have this exponential decay. So there's a correlation length associated with it. And now this is not the scale we would plot it on. And if it's exponential decay, if we just want to see that, we should plot it on a linear log scale, and then we should get a straight line if it's a pure exponential. And then from the slope, we just extract the correlation length. Now, as I said, there can be some power law modifications of this exponential, and to really extract the correlation length that way, you also have to make sure that you go to long enough distances and so on. The point is that it's a little bit messy to analyze those correlations, and it would be nice if you have some other equivalent way to extract the correlation length. And this is one way which people use a lot. So if we define what's called the structure factor, which is just the Fourier transform of the correlation function, and then you take a ratio of that correlation function at pi pi. So now I have a ladder or a two-dimensional system in mind here. If it's a 1D chain, it would just be pi. And then you take the ratio of this at the wave vector, which is the closest to pi, and now I didn't write what q is here. So q is two pi over l. So that's the smallest q you can have in a, well, so I should say if it's 2D, I should say qx and qy equals zero, or it could be vice versa. So if you have a finite system, this is that's the smallest wave vector. And now we want to take the ratio of these structure factors at the wave vector where we have the dominant correlations, so staggered antiferromagnetic correlations correspond to a peak in the structure factor at pi pi. And then we take the ratio with the value at q closest to pi pi. Okay, so I should really derive this for you, but it actually is a little bit messy to derive it. But one can, if you take an exponential form, and even with those power law prefactors that I mentioned, if you take such a form and just do that Fourier transform, take the ratio and construct this thing, you will get the same correlation length. You will not, well, with a caveat, actually, you will get the same correlation length in some limit where the correlation length diverges. In a situation where the correlation length is finite, which is, of course, normally what it is, these definitions will actually not be exactly the same. And that's because there are contributions here from the short distances where this behavior does not yet apply. This behavior or this behavior modified by a power law, there can be all kinds of other corrections at short distances. But that doesn't really matter. So normally, well, at least often when we talk about the correlation length, we're interested in a situation where it diverges. So in that kind of situation, these things do become equivalent. And in situations where the correlation length is not infinite, it doesn't really matter if you use two definitions. In fact, the correlation length is some length scale in the system, some typical length scale. But in some sense, there you can define it in many different ways. It depends on what quantity you look at to define the typical length scale and so on. And of course, if you have a pure power law decay, you can say, well, that psi is uniquely my length scale. But as I already said, there are some some power law prefactors normally, and at short distances anyway, we have some other corrections. So it's not clear always why the asymptotic decay should be your, defined as your typical length scale. Let me give you some extreme example here. So let's say I have a situation where eventually, okay, so let me give you the good example was, okay, this is just e to the minus r of xi, and that would be a good definition of the typical length scale. But let's say that the correlation correlation function behaves very strangely in some way like that, and then it starts to decay exponentially. Here, you know, maybe, okay, you have again some e to the minus r of xi here, but you can have some other behavior up to some length scale, let's call it just a, which can be different from xi. So then the question is, well, what is the typical length scale here? Probably there are actually two length scales there. And if you just want to characterize it by one number, this is actually not a bad thing to do. In any case, when psi is large, the differences between these two would normally be small anyway. All right, so this is one way to calculate the correlation length. It can also be done quite efficiently if you think about how to do the Fourier transform. If you just need a couple of points, you can actually figure out some efficient way of doing it, but let's not get into that. Let me show you what this gives in the case of these even length ladders. And now again, the length Lx is of the form 2 to the m. So m equals 10 corresponds to 1024. You see that there are finite size corrections here. So you have to go to a very, very long chain for this definition to converge. That would also be the case if you just extract it from the correlation function, because we have discussed many times that if you look at correlations in a periodic system, there are some influence of the boundaries if you go to long distances, and that was actually one reason also that it's a little bit complicated often to analyze them, those correlation functions. So here you just get a number, you plot it as a function of system size, and you want to see how it converges, if it converges. So you can see here in the case of L equals 6, I'm not quite converged yet. I would probably need to do twice or four times as long ladders to see it. These cases are, well, sort of converged at least. So what I plot here is just lines at 1.15 times delta, where delta is what we extracted before from the susceptibility, from this exponential low temperature form of the susceptibility, just to show that in fact the correlation length is more or less the inverse of the gap. So here the prefactor is something like 1.15. All right. So let me show you one other thing. So if we just take a two-leg ladder and we let the coupling become very weak between them, eventually if the chains decouple, we just have two independent chains. And we know that the two-leg ladders, in fact, regardless of how weak the coupling is, this is maybe not completely easy to see, but from all kinds of field theoretical RG treatments and so on, it follows that there is a gap and a finite correlation length for any non-zero coupling between the chains. And only in the limit when that coupling goes to zero do you get the behavior asymptotically of these 1 over r correlations. So what you can do is compute the correlation length in the two-leg ladder as a function of the coupling ratio between the chains and in the chains. And that should then diverge, because in the single chain the correlation length is infinite because we have power law correlations. So technically then these definitions that we have talked about, they would give infinite. So these are just some results I got, and okay, the results are not exactly on a straight line, but more or less it looks like the correlation length diverges linearly with this ratio. In fact, I would not be surprised if there's some logarithmic correction to this correlation length, but I haven't actually seen that discussed. But often, any time, since in the single 1D chain, we know that we have those logarithmic corrections, so anything that goes to the limit of that should also have some logarithmic features. Okay, so I hope that gave you some flavor about these spin chains and ladders, which are quite important systems in quantum magnetism. Also experimentally, there are lots of systems that consist of chains or consist of ladders, and people have confirmed these things. They are not in the same kind of quantitative way that you can do with models, but nevertheless, there are ladder systems that clearly show gaps. There are ones with an odd number of chains that clearly show no gap. And actually, I should have taken some pictures from experimental papers to show that. But now let's look at the 2D Heisenberg model. So you remember we did spin wave theory, and we computed, or you computed in your homework and in the tutorial. Maybe you are still computing it for your homework. The sublattice magnetization. So in linear spin wave theory, this is the number we got. People have gone to higher order, and as I mentioned already, that's quite complicated. It becomes really, really tricky once you include some corrections. It turns out that the next correction is of order 1 over s squared. So the 1 over s, to order 1 over s, the number doesn't even change. So you need to go to 1 over s squared. Then you get something like 0.307. And nobody has done anything beyond that. It's just too complicated. Now, I already mentioned at some point that quantum Monte Carlo gives something like 0.3074, so it's quite close agreement. Let me show you again some of those quantum Monte Carlo results. Actually, these results were not... So everything I showed before today was with the SSE method. This is actually not with the SSE method, although it could be. One would not see any difference, of course, but it just happens that this is obtained using a method which we will talk about tomorrow, which is working in this valence bond basis. But it doesn't matter. The points, if it's done correctly, should look exactly the same. So what I want to show here is that you can analyze the long-range order in two different ways, or even in more different ways, but here I show two ways. So these solid dots here is from computing the squared sublattice magnetization. So you remember the sublattice magnetization, as I have defined it before, is summing the spins over all lattice sites with this staggered factor, and then evaluating its square. And this is actually what you will do in the tutorial tomorrow. You will play with this quantum Monte Carlo program, and you will do things like that. But you will not go to these big systems. You will do maybe up to 16 by 16 or 20 by 20, but already there it's quite clear what you get. Okay, so if you extrapolate that, you get some number which corresponds to, if you take its square root, corresponds to this 0.307. You can also look at the correlation function at some fixed long, at some distance which grows with the system size. So it most natural would be to take the longest separation on these periodic lattices. And as we have discussed before, when we talked about the Ising models and so on, and this is valid here as well, that the long distance correlation function is also the squared long-range ordered moment. And you can see here that these agree really very well. So that's how we get this number. And again, it's quite or really very close to the spin wave result, which is not always the case. I should point out again that this linear, leading linear in 1 over L size correction, I guess I should say inverse size here, can be predicted from, well, it was predicted from spin wave theory at some point, but it also follows more generally from symmetry arguments and so on, but we cannot go into that here. But it's somehow consistent also with what the leading correction is. Although in practice, when you do things like this, if you just use 1 over L plus some constant form, you cannot fit the data up to here. You need to include some higher order corrections. So this is, I think these are fits to cubic or fourth order polynomials in this case, because the error bars here are so small, you cannot see even the error bars. They are really very small. So, well, the point was if you have big error bars, you could for sure fit 1 over L, but as you get increasingly good data, you increasingly start to see higher order corrections as well. Okay, now I want to mention another important property of these magnetic systems, and this is also something that you will explore tomorrow using the program. So the spin stiffness or the helicity modulus. So you know, if you have an elastic medium, you have all kinds of moduli in that system, which is these elastic constants, how stiff these materials are. And in spin systems, there are something, there's something similar called the spin stiffness or helicity modulus. So if you look at classical papers about classical spins, often they call it the helicity modulus. In quantum spin systems, often it's called the spin stiffness. So it corresponds to the Young's modulus of an elastic medium. So it tells you something about how stiff the system is to making distortions in this spin order. So it's one of the important ground state parameters in the sense that if you, like we do in an elastic medium is a hydrodynamic sort of description of, I mean, you can make have a hydrodynamic description of an elastic medium, and that's where these Young's moduli come in. In the same way, people have these such descriptions of spin systems. So, for example, if you do these continuum field theories and so on, the stiffness would be a parameter that comes in there. So normally we expect an ordered state to also be have a finite or non-zero stiffness. Although, actually, even if you have power law correlations, if the decay is slow enough, the you can also have a stiffness there. So the spin stiffness is actually equivalent to the superfluid stiffness of a boson system. So when we talk about spins, we talk about the stiffness, but if you do a boson system, which the Heisenberg model could be, I mean, it's a boson system with some particular interactions, it actually corresponds to the superfluid stiffness, which is related to the superfluid density. So what is this? How do we define it? So it's the sensitivity in the sense of a second derivative of the ground state energy with respect to a twist along a boundary. So let's look at this picture. This is just for a classical ferromagnet, but the idea is really the same. So let's say you have an ordered state, you have broken the symmetry, so the spins point mainly up, but maybe this is at some slightly elevated temperature, so you still have some spin fluctuations. And we have periodic boundary conditions in this system. So now any column here could be taken as a boundary or any row as well, but let's look at the column. And now I want to change the boundary condition along this column. So the column is in the y direction, but the change in the boundary condition is in the x direction, because this boundary cuts these x bonds here. So what I want to do is I want to twist the spins between here and here, and that will cost some energy. Well, it turns out that the leading energy shift is second order in this twist, so the spin stiffness is defined as 1 over L, and that corresponds to the fact that we have L, a system of length L, so we want to have something which is per spin. So if I twist the whole column, I get something which is proportional to L, and I want to divide it by L. So I want to do the expectation value of the energy at whatever twist and take the second derivative. If I did this at finite temperature, I should actually put the free energy there. So this is for the case of a zero temperature situation. So how do we do this twist? Well, that's really simple. So if you take the Heisenberg interaction is Si dot Sj, and now I imagine that I and J are across this boundary. So now if I twist the spins here, I can do that with the rotation matrix. So now I imagine that this is actually, let's see now, so here I show xy spins, but it could be Heisenberg spins as well. So let's say they are ordered in the z direction. So this is a ferromagnet, but it will be the same for the antiferromagnet as well. And now I want to rotate in a direction which is, let's see now, so I don't do it wrong. So it should be in a direction which is perpendicular to the order. If I just would twist the spins like that, not much would happen, right? But if I twist them in that direction or in that direction, it's something which should affect the energy. So this is a rotation in spin space you should keep in mind. So these are the spin operators with their components, and now I rotate one of these or all the ones on one run. So that makes some frustration in it. I think this is clearer if you just imagine twisting 180 degrees. So then it's really making the boundary conditions antiperiodic instead of periodic, right? And that you can imagine that costs energy. So if I have a ferromagnet, all the spins want to point up. If I make the boundary condition antiferromagnetic, then, okay, at that boundary they would like to be like that. But in fact, that mismatch will spread out all over the system. So the system will adjust to the boundary condition, but nevertheless, the energy should go up if I have that kind of phase twist. So this is you can in fact define this in terms of completely changing the boundary condition by rotating 180 degrees as well, but it's more convenient to just imagine a very, very small twist. Now, so this is quite interesting because one can show, and actually it's not even so difficult to show, but it would probably take me half an hour or an hour if I really want to do it, so I'm just going to tell you what it is, and that has to be it today. But one can show if you just, for example, in the SSE formalism, if you just write down what the energy would be in if you put in this kind of rotation matrix, and then you just take the second derivative and look at the consequences in terms of the configurations and so on, you will find that the stiffness, and now I write in a given direction here, just corresponding to the fact that we could put this in the boundary in the y direction or x direction. So x actually corresponds to the column in the y direction, because I imagine that it's the x boundary being changed. It's related to the winding numbers which we talked about before. So if we go back to this picture that we looked at for the winding numbers, so now we have a periodic system, and here it was in the boson language, but it's the same with spins. You should just think of a boson as spin up and the absence of a boson as spin down. So this is a configuration with winding number 1, actually winding number 3. The way it's defined this is the way the winding number should be defined. So we take our SSE slices going this direction. It could be in the world line picture as well. It's actually completely identical. And then we look at the currents. So whenever a boson jumps, the current is 1 if it jumps in the positive x direction, and it's -1 if it jumps in the negative direction. And then we just add up those currents. So then if we don't have any winding, it's clear that we have as many left and right left movers as right movers, so the net current is just 0. But if we have a winding like we have here, then so this actually should have winding number 1. So if you add up all the currents, you will get actually L, when L is the direction. So the winding number is the total current divided by L. Yeah?
So why don't you get a contribution of L from each of the other bosons, though, for a total of winding number 3?
Yeah, that was what I was thinking first, but now I think if I see it here, I think if they permute once, you just get L. Because you see, this one doesn't by itself go one complete term.
Oh, I see.
Right. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, but when I started to talk, I thought exactly like you. Now this must have 3, but then, you know, when I...
No, that makes sense.
Right. So then what the superfluid, what the spin stiffness is, which is equivalent, if you talk about bosons, to the superfluid stiffness, is related to the fluctuation of this winding number. You see, this is the squared winding number expectation value. So the expectation of the winding number itself, of course, is 0 because I have equal winding left and right. So this is really the fluctuation of the winding number. And it should be divided by beta. It turns out where beta is the inverse temperature. And this 3/2 actually comes from rotational averaging. So now when I did something like this, I imagine that my order is in the z direction and I rotate in a direction perpendicular to that direction. But we don't break the symmetry in the simulation, so this will be rotationally averaged, and that 3/2 turns out to be related to that. So in your tutorial, I also want you to compute the winding number. So again, I have a program which does it, but I just want you to... So it's computing this thing, and you can imagine it's very simple to compute it. You have the configurations, and then you just keep track of the jumps, and any time you have an S plus, S minus operator, that corresponds to a jump to the left or to the right. So it does that, so you will run the program and get results for different lattice sizes, and then just seeing how it behaves as a function of system size. And you should see that it goes to a non-zero number. Please.
I have two questions. The first is, for the definition of gamma as of D rho as gamma.
Yeah.
And the simplification here, you see that it's positive. My first question is there a significance of it being negative? And secondly, can we generalize this to have a matrix if it is positive, but does the matrix necessarily need to be positive definite?
Okay, so the stiffness itself has to be positive, right? Because this is square of winding numbers. Yeah. And gamma is the x and y direction. So if you take a system which is square, L times L, then the stiffness should be the same in x and y direction. If you take Lx different from Ly, which, in fact, you can do in the program I will give to you, so you may want to look at that situation too. For any finite lattice, then, they will be different. You will get different stiffnesses for the x and y direction. That's just physically clear. If you take a sheet of metal or something and it's rectangular, if you twist in one direction, it's different from if you twist in the other direction. But since we eventually normalize it to be something per bond, if you will, when the size goes to infinity, it should not matter what the geometry was. Now, what was your other question?
Other question was, if the stiffness has to be positive,
right,
and we are generalizing it maybe 2 by 2 or 3 by 3 to form a matrix, do we have positive dimensions?
Okay, so now you mean if you want to consider not just the diagonal elements of that matrix, but also the off-diagonal elements. Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, I suspect that the off-diagonal elements would all be zero here. So let's see what would they correspond to. So they would. Well, actually, I should say one thing. In this case, for these bipartite systems, the stiffness always has to be positive. There can be actually cases where, I mean, so one assumption here is that the minimum energy is for zero twist. Now, this is quite natural in these antiferromagnets, but actually if we go to something like a frustrated system, it can happen that the minimum energy is not at zero twist. And then one has to do something else, and then if you would just compute it, assuming that the minimum is at zero twist, you may actually get a negative value. And the reason you could get that is because in those systems, we have a sign problem. So if we compute things like this, we would have to put some signs in there as well. And it could actually go negative. But about generalizing it to a matrix with off-diagonal elements, actually, I don't know what that would give us. So I somehow suspect that the off-diagonal elements should all vanish. So that's my guess. Okay, let's move on. So now I want to talk about the stiffness in quantum critical systems. So you are going to look at the stiffness yourself for the 2D Heisenberg model, and I want to now move on to talk about quantum criticality. This was supposed to show up a little bit later, but that's fine. So now I want to look at quantum criticality in these dimerized systems. So first I'm going to just discuss the critical point, and then I want to show you how the spin stiffness scales at the critical point. And then tomorrow we will discuss these valence bond methods, and I think I will have time to talk a little bit about another quantum phase transition as well. But let's look at this bilayer a little bit. So we discussed it qualitatively before, so we could dimerize a system in many different ways in such that each spin belongs to one dimer, and then if that coupling inside the dimer becomes large, we will have a quantum phase transition between the Nell state and this kind of singlet product state. So for G equals infinite, it would really be a singlet product state. As you come here, you have lots of fluctuations, but you can, in some cartoonish way, you can think of the system as forming singlets. And that's what's driving the transition. So I mentioned that it's believed that these Heisenberg models in this kind of situation, they map onto basically 2 plus 1 dimensional classical spins. So this is done in a sort of spin coherent state basis. So you can, since we have talked about the path integral now, at least you can believe that if you take a quantum system, you can map it to some classical statistical mechanics problem in one higher dimension. I mean, that's what the path integral is doing. But of course, it's not clear that new dimension is somehow equivalent to the spatial dimensions. In fact, it looks quite different. But if you do it in another basis, we did it just with the spin up in the spin up and down basis. One can do it with coherent spin states and doing it for large spin and so on. And what Haldane showed that what you get is some effective Heisenberg model in one higher dimension. It's highly anisotropic. So the third dimension is still has a coupling which is very different from the spatial dimensions. In fact, it should be the extreme anisotropic limit. But nevertheless, you get something like that. Well, these derivations are not completely rigorous, but they are somehow also what one can expect based on symmetries and so on. So based on these arguments and studies of these, there are these effective continuum field theories that one can study. But the universality class of this transition should be the 3D Heisenberg universality class. So exponents and so on in this two-dimensional quantum spin system should be the same as we get in the three-dimensional classical temperature-driven transition. So there's one thing we need to discuss there, which I didn't mention before. Namely, so this is quite general beyond these particular models, completely general in the context of quantum phase transitions. So there's something called the dynamic exponent, and this is an exponent which relates space and time directions. So if we take our system, and let's say now we have a 1D system, so this is the spatial direction R, and then when we do a path integral or something like that, we get another direction, and we call that the time direction. And as I already mentioned, there's, at least looking at it, just looking at the path integral and so on, it's not looking at the configurations we get. It's not clear that, what are the relationships between the time and space direction. Are they somehow equivalent? So in this case, would correspond to some kind of Lorentz invariance. The time and space directions are somehow the same. In general, it need not be the case. So there's this dynamic exponent, which is an exponent which relates the space and time directions in the sense of the correlation length. So we know that in the space direction we can compute correlation functions, and at a critical point those correlations have some power law dependence, and also the correlation length diverges as we go to the critical point. We can also measure correlations in time. So in addition to just measure correlations in space, or if we of course have many states here, so we could measure correlations at equal time, we can also measure correlations at different times, same space coordinate. We can also measure correlations, space time correlations, any way we like. And we can also that way define a correlation length in the time direction. And the dynamic exponent relates those two. So in general, the dynamic exponent does not have to be one. There are many examples where z is 2 or 3 or even 4. So in that case, the correlation length in the time direction diverges much faster. In these spin systems, normally the dynamic exponent is 1. And the finite size gap is actually also related to the dynamic exponent. So the finite size gap in any system at the critical point should scale as L to the minus Z. And in fact, we didn't really look at it in detail, but in the Heisenberg chain delta, the gap also scales like 1 over L, and that also corresponds to Z equals 1, but I guess we didn't really talk about that. So these are two important consequences of this mapping to one higher dimension. And now when we look at finite size scaling, you remember we looked at various definitions of exponents, and we looked at in the context of classical models, and we looked at how to extract things from finite size scaling. In some cases, there's some D, the dimensionality, appearing in various expressions. So the only thing essentially that happens in, if when you analyze quantum systems, is that you replace D by D plus Z. So when Z is 1, you just, and let's say we look at a two-dimensional system, then it's like looking at a three-dimensional system, and it's again related to this up here, that this kind of models should map to Heisenberg models in one more dimension, so that other dimension, effectively speaking, will be the same as the space dimension, so we just get one more dimensionality, one more dimension. So, okay, let me quickly show one result, and then we will do the rest tomorrow. So let's look at this system, and let's analyze that. So what we can do in these systems is we want to look at the ground state. So that means taking the temperature very low, taking it below the gap, so then we get really the ground state. Another possibility, if we know what Z is that we choose the space direction to be proportional to L times Z. That corresponds to having the correct geometry for analyzing criticality. In this case, Z is believed to be 1, so then we can just look at systems where we choose the inverse temperature proportional to L. Let me just flash one result here and we can do more next time. We can look at the Binder ratio that we discussed in the case of the Ising model, and you recall that curves for different L of the Binder ratio should cross at the critical point. And you see for this model, they do. We get some curve crossings here, and that's how we can extract the critical point. Here I did beta equals L. But if you remember in the Ising model, we got this really almost perfect curve crossings. Here you can see clearly there are large corrections. We need to go to quite big systems to really convince ourselves that it crosses in one point. Carefully analyzing this, one can see that it really goes, accumulates to one point. So next time, let's look at some other results for this model. All right, see you then.